The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler, and for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the Washington Post, the Miami Herald, and the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to spend some time attending some unique events and places in the Netherlands, Belgium, and France. Then we're going to head to the Port of Miami for a special cruise ship tour. Now, we're going to begin with this headline. Want to drive through Europe? Try this route from Amsterdam to Paris. Writer Jessica van Duf de Jesus tells us about renting a car in the Netherlands, then going off the beaten path to such stops as Gouda and Dijon. Her article appeared in the June 17, 2024 issue of the Washington Post. So let us begin our journey. One of the first words you should learn in France or Belgium is grève, the French word for strike, because you'll often hear it in the local news. During the past few years, strikes have consistently interrupted European airlines and rail services. Instead of being vulnerable to tricky cross-country connections, travelers should consider renting a car. That's even more appropriate if you're in a small group of people who enjoy going off the beaten path. As Americans head to Europe over the summer, many will try to fit several countries into an itinerary. A road trip allows you more flexibility and access to places that are harder to connect by rail or plane. Even for locals, traveling by car can be a fun alternative. I'm all about driving, flexibility, and accessibility, says Jane Birch, the founder of the Paris-based cooking school La Cuisine Paris and author of The French Ingredient. Stay off the highways and stop by small villages for lunch and shopping. I love buying and food and wine as souvenirs and not having to deal with baggage on a plane or train. It's a plus. Renting a car in Europe. If you're used to driving in the United States, driving in Europe may seem more relaxed. Road rules are mostly the same in continental Europe, except the United Kingdom and Ireland, where you drive on the left side. Keep in mind that the speed limits are in kilometers per hour, not miles. Even after almost 10 years of living in Europe, I still have to do the math in my head. The easiest way to figure it out is to multiply the number by 0.60. It's actually 0.62, but you should go with the easier math to avoid speeding tickets, and they will find you, she interjects. The Netherlands and Belgium have speed cameras that capture the average speed of a trip rather than one moment on the road, so set your cruise control and don't worry about the people zipping by you. Renting a car is straightforward in Western Europe. Most of the big brands in the United States, Hertz, Budget, Avis, Enterprise, are available at most large airports. I stick to those brands because I can earn my airline miles and address many issues at the corporate level back home. As for driving licenses, I've rented cars from Austria to Greece and have never been asked for an international driving permit. If you're pulled over, however, having one could save you a ticket. They're only $20 with an easy application process via AAA. Roads and parking spots are often much smaller in most of Europe than in the United States, so be careful about how large of a car you rent. You can get a small SUV, but I wouldn't recommend anything larger than a Volkswagen Tiguan or a BMW X3. Also, if you can't drive a manual, specify an automatic car in your booking, as manual vehicles are still pretty standard across Europe. Electric vehicles are more common in Western Europe than in the United States, and there are plenty of charging stations along the highways, parking garages, and most urban neighborhoods. If you choose to rent an electric car, plan your stops around your charging time. That's also an excellent way to explore a small town. Grab lunch and go for a little stroll while your car charges. Use apps like PlugShare to find charging stations, which display availability and the type of chargers supported. Google Maps works just as well in Europe as in the United States, so it's an excellent tool for road trips. Another tip is to pay for parking in advance when visiting big cities. For example, when I drive to the Netherlands, I use a website called ParkBee. Now, Amsterdam is notorious for its high parking fees, but I still find parking spaces for 20 euros a day. In France, one park offers a similar service. Now we're going to start from Amsterdam. After a few days strolling along the city's quaint canals and admiring the Dutch masters at the Rijksmuseum, we're going to pick up the rental at Schiphol Airport and head south to Brussels, which should take less than 3 hours. Now, stop in Gouda, Netherlands. Gouda is known for its cheese, but also for its history. The city is more than 750 years old. The charming city center, with warm stroopwafels and enticing cheese, present a more laid-back side to Holland without the mass tourism of Amsterdam's city center. Now, you can look up the many Kasbordelijs cheese farms on the outskirts of Gouda. One of my favorite is Kasbordelijs de Tweehoven. Stop in Brussels. Brussels is known for its Art Nouveau, architecture, gastronomy, and, of course, chocolates. A stop at the Grand Place, where you can also find several parking garages, is a must. Afterward, walk to the Sablon, known for its art galleries, chocolate shops, and weekend antique market. With your car parked, explore the city by metro, tram, or bus, and head to St. Giles and Excels. These local favorite neighborhoods are teeming with cozy cafes and a bustling restaurant scene where you can eat Belgian classics, a pot teeming with mussels with a side of frites, and La Quincicalerie, or a crispy gray shrimp croquette at Fernando Oab. You can also explore global cuisines ranging from Vietnamese to Congolese cuisine, reflecting the city's diverse population. Stop in Denoy, Belgium. Make some time for the charming, well-preserved medieval city in Wallonia in southern Belgium. Take a boat ride along the Meuse River with a view of the rolling hills of the Ardennes. Go for a tour of the Citadel of Dijon and stock up on chocolates and artisanal local cheeses. Now, you can also stop in Reims, France. It takes less than 3 hours to drive from Brussels to the Champagne region. Make your base at Reims, where you can walk or take public transportation via bus or tram to many champagne producers. Having a car will allow you to explore other picturesque champagne-producing towns like Aix-en-Champagne, Bouzeuil, and Avis, as many of these small towns either don't have train stations or only have limited schedules. These towns have independent producers whose products are hard to find outside of France. Just make sure someone agrees to be a designated driver. If you're on a wine trip, be sure to spit, as the legal limit is equivalent to 0.05% blood alcohol content. The standard in the USA is 0.08%. Depending on the size of the pour and your size, even one drink could put you above the limit, says Caro Freely, co-founder and director of Chateau Freely, a winery and guest house in the south of France. Stop in Lyon, France. Known as the gastronomic capital of France, Lyon, with its cozy taverns known as Bouchon Lyonnaise, serving local fare such as pâtés and sausage-stuffed brioche and Côte de Trône wines, has an entirely different feel than Paris, with a less touristy vibe in restaurants and bars catering to the home crowd. Just as in other cities, there are plenty of parking garages where you can secure a spot in advance. Lovers of French cuisine should include a stop in the Le Hall de Leon Paul Bouscoon, a food hall with several restaurants for oyster shuckers, decadent cheeses, charcuterie, and wine. For stunning city views, catch a funicular to the Basilique Notre Dame à Forbière, a UNESCO World Stop. Now, you can stop in Dijon, France, known for its mustard. Burgundy's capital has a picturesque city center worth a stop with its cobblestone streets and Gothic architecture. It's a good place for a petite pause. Then we stop in Paris. You could return your rental car to Lyon and take the TGV, that's the fast train to Paris, which will take 2 hours. But if you're looking for more adventure, drive back to Paris and head to Agen, a small city in the Burgundy region, for a petite pause. Also, take advantage of the car to go to landmarks on the outskirts of Paris, like Versailles and Parc des Bois, and a bit more east. The latter is the home of Fondation Louis Vuitton, which not only houses magnificent artworks, but also Frank Gehry designed buildings and gardens that are just as impressive. Well, our writer, by the way, Jessica Van Doop de Jesus, is a travel and food writer and a digital content creator, author of the book, The Dining Traveler Guide to Puerto Rico. Now, she divides her time between Brussels, D.C., and Western New York, and you can follow her on Instagram if you're interested more about some of her travels. Just check out at Dining Traveler. That's at Dining Traveler on Instagram. Now, our journey takes us to the outside of Paris. The location is Le Mans, where writer Gregory Leperati tells us about the most epic all-nighter in sports, how racing fans survive Le Mans. Now, as the editors characterize it, the 24 Hours of Le Mans is a legendary auto race and France's biggest tailgate party. And the story that he writes is in the June 15, 2023 issue of the Washington Post. Let's see here. Dateline Le Mans. It's nearly 3 a.m. at the 24 Hours of Le Mans, and Stephen Julia is struggling, despite having chugged some energy drinks and espresso earlier in the evening. The Frenchman is slouched over the grandstands, finding it hard to stay awake for the entirety of the famous day-long car race. But with engines roaring past him every few seconds, he's finding it even harder to fall asleep. "Now, I'm in a strange state of half awake, half asleep," he says with a laugh. A sleeping bag is wrapped around his legs, and he crouches over and shuts his eyes whenever there is a brief lull in the race. "I, too, had to make the trek to Le Mans last weekend. That would have been in June 2023, and I spent the bulk of the overnight hours in my seat or staring glassy-eyed at the race cars, with hotels filling up quickly and costing exorbitant prices. Thousands of fans each year choose to lay out in the grandstands or camp out in the patches of grass overlooking the track, intent on not missing a second of the action. It's the true Le Mans experience," Julia said. Now, located at Circuit de la Sarthe in the town of Le Mans, about an hour train ride, I should say, outside of Paris, the 24 Hours of Le Mans is one of the world's most unusual sporting events, popularized recently in the United States by the 2019 movie Ford versus Ferrari. This year marked its centennial, drawing a record 325,000 spectators to the circuit. Now, sports royalty LeBron James and Tom Brady were in attendance, presumably not sleeping in the grandstands, and even NASCAR, the American Stock Car Series, was participating. And if fans were tired, imagine how the drivers felt. During the race, teams raced continuously for 24 straight hours, with three drivers per team putting in hours-long stints behind the wheel. Finishing the race in one piece is considered a success. While winning, it is one of the crowning achievements in motorsports. As the hours rolled by and night blended into morning, a variety of fans shared their stories and strategies for tackling this wild, sleepless spectacle. 24 hours of toilet lines. Well, during the race, the more than 8-mile-long track at Circuit de la Sarthe turns into a makeshift town unto itself, with restaurants, shops, carnivals, and bars popping up across each section of the circuit. Rock concerts and movie marathons go on during the race, and an on-site museum is free for anyone with a ticket. A shuttle bus takes fans to different parts of the track. "There's too much to do in just 24 hours," says Manuel Garcia, a man from Spain who was attending his 7th Le Mans. He had arrived a couple of days earlier with just a few extra clothes, a small tent, and some food. "And I have a little bit of what I love the most, French wine," he said. "Yes, you can bring outside food and beverages with you, though concession stands had tasty offerings. Sandwiches, wraps, French pastries, salads, and more items all looked fresher and maybe a tad healthier than what you might find in a typical U.S. stadium. But drink sizes tend to be smaller than what most Americans are accustomed to. Starbucks Venti size and 7-Eleven's Big Gulp are foreign concepts in French." As the opening ceremony began, leading up to a 4 p.m. start, I tried to meticulously plan my day. I'd watch the start and first few hours from the stands, then make my way to the museum and carnival areas. After catching some live music and 3-hour pop concert, I'd swing back to watch more racing and speak with campers. All the while, more experienced racegoers advised me to keep my eyes peeled for the best bathrooms. "That's the real challenge," said Tom Sims, an engineer from the United Kingdom who had traveled nearly 12 hours overnight to make it in time for the start of the race. "I'm always making a mental note as I walk across the track to figure out which ones have the shortest queues," he said. Some bathrooms had lines appearing to be well over 50 people long. At one point, I saw a woman throw up her hands and walk away, tired of the wait. "This should be called the 24 hours of toilet line," she said. Tents fit for a butler. Well, while some spectators lay out in the grandstands or pitch a small tent, others get a bit more creative. There are multiple campgrounds across the circuit, and they turn into giant parties during the late night hours of the race. As I walked through one camping area in a section of the track called Terre Rouge, a group of fans from the Netherlands asked me to join them for a beer and kebab. Their setup featured a giant tent, big-screen TV broadcasting the race, and I see it better from here, one of them told me, speakers and a refrigerator full of beer also. "Well, every year we do something a little bigger, a little better," said Marcel Boulin, one of the group's de facto ringleaders. "One time we built a beautiful table, covered it with linen and candles, and had our friend dressed like a butler in service." Well, Europop blared out of the speakers at a nearby tent, just barely obscuring the humming engines that provide constant background noise at Le Mans. A group of English fans placed a chair on top of their RV for a perfect view of the racetrack and evening fireworks. I heard stories about other campsites that had karaoke and smoke machines. A key benefit of camping is having your own shelter in the event of rain. Occasional showers are typical at Le Mans and happened a handful of times during this year's race, again 2023. Each time it rained, fans would go scurrying under awnings at concession stands and restaurants, while some remained watching from the sidelines, wearing ponchos and embracing elements. Sleeping, as I learned, was considered optional. Many of the campers said they would potentially take short naps in their tents at some point in the early pre-dawn hours. Others who traveled solo, without big camping setups, told me they would try to nap in the back seats of their cars. Some recommended headphones or earplugs to drown out the noise and the race cars. But mostly people encouraged sleeping as little as possible. "Who wants to sleep with all this going on?" Boulin said. As fun as camping seemed, others took a more conventional approach. Mark Solis from San Francisco told me he had been lucky to snatch up a nearby Airbnb many months before the race, back when they were still available. He planned to head back to his B&B about 2 a.m., then plan to return to the race the next morning. "I do a lot of camping just for fun," he said, "but here it's a different animal. Generators, TVs, these guys are ready for anything. An extra night of partying." As the evening hours rolled on and a few brief rain showers came and went, I could hear groans and snores from the grandstands. Sleeping bags began stirring as the sun crept up over the racetrack around 6 a.m., as the smell of espresso and fresh croissants filled the air in nearby concession stands. Well, a new day of racing had arrived, and the action proved exciting. Ferrari, after a long absence from competing in the top class of Le Mans, pulled out a surprising victory over Toyota. And as a scrum of elated, sweaty, and weary friends gathered on the side of the track to celebrate the top finishers, it smelled as if no one had bathed in about a month. Even as a spectator, making it to the end of the race brought with it a sense of victory. We, too, had survived the 24 hours of Le Mans. Now, once the celebration had wrapped up, fans streamed out of the racetrack and packed the local tram. Many, like me, were heading to the central station to catch a train back to Paris. I fought the urge to sleep so I could keep my internal clock on mostly normal schedule. Some of the campers, meanwhile, had planned to stay into Monday morning, assuring me they would keep partying going. "Well, that was amazing," said Sebastian Dubois, a Canadian fan who was also attending his first Le Mans. He estimated he had slept for about a half hour at most in a patch of grass next to the track. Wearing water-resistant pants, pants and a poncho, he had endured even the rainiest parts of the race. "It was wonderful to shut your eyes and just hear the engines roar," he said. "It's addicting. I'm already thinking about next year." Well, from Le Mans, we're going to travel across the continent. Actually travel across the Atlantic, let me put it that way. And we're going to catch a view of the Central Park on Royal Caribbean's Icon of the Seas, the world's largest cruise ship. Now, it's docked at Port Miami for this article after arriving to its home base in Miami for the first time, this on January 11th, 2024. Now, Vinod Srihara's story, headlined "Here's the First Book Inside the Icon of the Seas, World's Biggest Cruise Ship," originally appeared in the Miami Herald and then was published in the January 24, 2024 issue of the News and Observer. The first thing passengers see entering the Icon of the Seas and its central walkway, the Royal Promenade, notice is a gigantic orb structure. Now, it's called the Pearl. It's a five-deck, tall glass surface supported by steel and lined on the inside with more than 3,000 tiles. Right under it is a majestic staircase, reminiscent of an Italian palace, that takes guests up to the Pearl Cafe on one side and Latin nightclub on the other. Tall windows abound. The Pearl structure allows the ship to have more open design and layout, which results in far greater natural light and exposure to the sea when compared to other vessels owned by Royal Caribbean International. Now, one reason the Pearl exists is to get ocean views at the heart of the ship, says Jay Snyder, Chief Product Innovation Officer for Royal Caribbean, in an interview with the Miami Herald. "It feels the energy of the Royal Promenade," he said. Now, we're going to switch from Royal Caribbean to Caribbean for the rest of our script, and there are two pronunciations. Both are acceptable, one U.S., one British. After much anticipation and hype, the 1,198-feet-long vessel with a capacity of 5,610 guests reached Port Miami on January 10th. Again, this was 2024. It will be based year-round, focused on a week-long or shorter trips to the Caribbean. Royal Caribbean International's headquarters are also here. It has over 40 restaurants and drinking establishments, including two dueling piano bars, three-story townhouses for large families, and over 33,000 plants in what dubs Central Park, one of its neighborhoods. About 1,000 people visit the Icon and its decks on January 11th. They were largely media and employees with Royal Caribbean. Now, employees then began a two-night demo cruise Thursday night in the Bahamas, and that was on January 16th, 2024. Royal Caribbean will have a few more short trips for them, their families, and then travel agents and VIPs. That all comes ahead of its first cruise for the public, and that was scheduled that year for January 27th. The Icon of the Seas is the first new class of ships from Royal Caribbean in nearly a decade, with 2,850 staterooms, 18 guest decks, 7 pools, each with 2 lifeguards, and a crew of 2,350. It's considered by cruise industry experts the largest cruise ship in the world at the moment. Snyder, Royal Caribbean's Chief Product Innovation Officer, told the Miami Herald there were multiple goals in creating this new class of ship. One was making it easier to get around. "We've heard over the years challenges guests have had with movement around the ship," said Snyder. "Our focus has been to dramatically improve that. The Pearl is one of their solutions. The open structure permits passengers to go from deck 2 to deck 8 without having to go out of the way to find an elevator." The company also sought to open up its venues. For example, it has the Latin nightclub on its other ships, but with a closed facade. On the Icon, they removed the facade. Now, another main objective with the Icon is to provide what the Royal Caribbean executive called unrivaled water experiences, or to surround passengers by water or the ocean as much as possible. That means pools facing the area, one is at the edge of the ship, and even beds that can be adjusted to ensure they face the ocean. "You are going to have this whole sense that you're part of the ship, but also part of the sea," said John Lovell, president of Travels Leaders Group. On Chill Island on Deck 16 is a swim-up full-service bar called Swim and Tonic. Now, guests can order imbibed drinks while seated in chairs, half immersed in the pool or hot tub. and whichever option one chooses, there's a great view of the sea. Now, Thrill Island is also on Deck 16 in one of eight neighborhoods. It has six water slides, a surfing area, rock climbing wall facing the ocean, and a mini golf course. An adventure called Crown's Edge allows thrill seekers to hang 154 feet above the ocean. Royal Caribbean also wanted to up its game in catering to families and in providing food and entertainment, Snyder said. At the highest end is the Empire Supper Club, which offers eight-course meals, including caviar and wagyu, every dish paired with a drink. Most eateries, though, are casual, such as family-style Italian restaurant and Pearl Cafe, which makes fresh sandwiches, ready-made salads, and desserts. Izumu offers Japanese street food and Japanese teriyaki ice cream, and there are more hibachi tables than the Icon. Sorrento's, a popular pizza place on Royal Caribbean's Oasis class of ships, is designed with more counter space and with the goal of reducing lines and improving the flow of guests, which was becoming a complaint. We wanted to get rid of the lines as much as possible, Snyder said. Now, Pearl's Cafe importance stems from the feedback the company got that passengers want more food that they can take out or grab and go when in a rush, especially those with kids who are on the move. Little about the Icon has been rushed. It's been a long time in the making. It goes back to at least 2017. The general plan for the ship and arrangement of decks were all locked in by 2018. The design of the interiors and the number of rooms were finalized by 2019. Construction broke around the steel cutting in June 2021. Still in recent weeks and months, work has not stopped. After construction at the Meyer Turku shipyard in Turku, Finland, there were sea trials last June, October, and November. A Herald reporter visited Snyder at his office in Miami on November 13, 2023, days after he returned from Finland and right after the final sea trial. He said then that they had a list of about three dozen requested changes they wanted to make. In one case, his team noticed that planned lights fixed on the counter of the lobby bar were in reality much bigger than they seemed on paper, reducing guest access to the bartenders. And so those lights are all getting removed, said Snyder. Meanwhile, the company decided then it should up its game in mini golf and make the course more tied to Thrill Island and thematic. So in November, it added sunken boats and a fallen plane. Well, Thrill Island itself only came together the past 2 years. In 2021, the ship had four water slides and one tower, and then six, but still one tower. It also had a rock climbing wall farther away, but that did not seem right, so they decided to bring them all closer together. They also added a second tower. The goal is now at full capacity if every kid wants to go on a ride. Wait times will be under 20 minutes, Snyder said. Meanwhile, at the Pearl Cafe, as of November, it had a glass barrier between the coffee barista at one end and customer. The original idea was the guest would order coffee and then receive it at the other end of the counter on the assumption he or she bought other items, like sandwiches or pastries, and there would be one point of sale. But on one of the many walkthroughs the company did, the food and beverage team objected to the glass barrier between the coffee barista and customer, thinking it impeded the flow of guests. It looked great designed this way, but as we started to operationalize, the team said, it'd really be helpful if we didn't have a glass panel over there, said Snyder. On January 11th, no glass barrier. There you go. That's how you make the biggest cruise ship. Now, that brings us to the end of today's journey of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.